Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to series two of Notable. Who'd have thought it?
Series
when
two.
We started series one all those months ago.
I know. Series two or season two if you're listening to us in America.
That's right. Yep. Yep. We do have some listeners in America.
We do.
We're big in, where is it again? Croatia.
We're big in Bosnia and the Cayman Islands. We were briefly top of the arts podcast chart in Bosnia and the Cayman Islands. Yeah. So a big hello to our fans and friends in Bosnia and the Cayman Islands.
Yeah. We promise to come and see you.
Absolutely. We've booked our flights to the Cayman Islands as soon as lockdown allows. We should say thank you so much to everybody who listened and downloaded season one and for all the lovely things you said about it. All of season one is still available.
Absolutely.
If you missed it, if you're just joining us now, that's
wherever
fine.
Wherever you get your podcast.
Wherever you get your podcast from. But do continue to get in touch with us and support us and download and favourite and whatever it is you do.
We're at Twitter.
We're on Twitter at NotablePod.
So people can catch us there. We're also on Instagram.
Shall we say who we are in case people don't know?
So, let me just get the notable handle.
Oh, okay.
You're right, it's at NotablePod. Oh, Stuart, you know it by heart.
At NotablePod.
There you go.
I'm Stuart McConey.
I'm Elizabeth Holker. And Notable, if you haven't listened to series one, it's curious tales from the world of music, isn't it, Stuart? And pretty much any kind of music, spanning the whole, 2,000
years
or more.
Interesting, fascinating bits of history, culture, curiosities from the world of music. As Elizabeth says, any genre of music is grist to our mill. Music in the most broad and loosest sense in some ways. And we're kicking off season two with, we're going to talk about the Beatles and how they tried to make a film of The Lord of the Rings.
Amazing. And I'm going to tell you the story, the extraordinary story of the life of Josephine Baker.
Great.
Singer, movie star, erotic dancer, resistance fighter.
And activist. Certainly that's what it says on my business card. But Josephine Baker, Josephine Baker got there first, and we'll tell you about that. Let's start, though, by talking. Are you familiar with the popular series of books, The Lord of the Rings, Elizabeth?
I am, but you know, I hate The Lord of the Rings. So,
well, that's lost us a lot of listeners straight away.
I liked The Hobbit when I was about seven, and then I remember trying to read Lord of the Rings as a teenager and just thinking, oh my goodness, this is the worst and most boring book I've ever picked up, ever. It's like Groundhog Day. It's like being stuck in a terrible dream that you can't get out of. You know, like, so you're on the edge of like a terrible thing happening, and then this like wizard shows up and saves you just in the nick of time, but then literally 5 minutes down the road you find yourself in the same position and you can't wake up because you're ill. It's like that kind of dream, and then there's this horrible ring that turns you into like a lizard or something.
In the interest of balance, I will say that despite Elizabeth's criticisms, it's quite popular, the Lord of the Rings series of novels, and so are the films based on them. I quite liked it when I was a teenager. I think it gets a bad press because
by me,
I think people go, oh, Lord of the Rings. No, but also people go, it's often like nerdy people. It's actually really, it's a monumental achievement by Tolkien. And the films by Peter Jackson have introduced it to a whole new
generation.
Yeah. Of people.
I just remember being on holiday with my grandma and granddad and watching the films, and these trees started running. And I was thinking,
Ents.
Oh, Ents.
Yeah, it's not a documentary. I think we should point that out. If anybody...
I was like, this is beyond the pale.
It is very much a fantasy. In fact, some could say that it invented the genre that is called fantasy.
Okay.
But the films, There is a predating film to the Peter Jackson films made by Saul Zentz, an animated, he never got the money to complete it, an animated version of the first two books, I think. But before then, incredibly, there was nearly a version with the Beatles in it.
This is just
starring the
isn't it?
Beatles. And we're going to tell you about that. Let's talk first about Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. He's a professor at Oxford. I'll get a bit of background in case you need it. Professor at Oxford. He teaches Anglo-Saxon, medieval Welsh and Old Icelandic. He's translated Beowulf. And he writes essentially in the beginning for fun and as a linguistic experiment. After The Hobbit, this trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. The Hobbit comes out in 1937. The Lord of the Rings comes out in 1954. I mean, I won't go into the detail about what they're about, but surely we know what we're talking about here. We're talking about a fantasy world of good versus evil in a kingdom
elves.
That involves elves, running wizards,
trees,
dwarves,
wizards.
Running trees, as Elizabeth said. Although
what are they called? Ents.
Ents. Although it comes out in 1954, or the three volumes, I should say, there are three separate volumes in the trilogy, it really booms in popularity in the 60s when the hippies embrace it, which is interesting because Tolkien was very conservative Catholic, not really very keen on the pop culture, certainly not on the counterculture.
Well, the story, it mirrors, you know, the story of Christianity, essentially, doesn't it? It's good versus evil.
Good versus evil. It also,
there's redemption and, you know, salvation.
It also mirrors the Second World War, although he was always very keen to say that it's not an allegory of the Second World War, but as it was written pretty much contemporaneous with the Second World War, it's hard to resist the temptation to say that it was. But yeah, the hippies go for it because it's fantastical. Man, it's got wizards, it's got elves. Yeah. You know,
a bit like Alice in Wonderland
exactly.
was the same, wasn't it?
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
Going down the rabbit hole. There are many holes that you can fall down if you depending on what substance hits you.
Well, that's an interesting thing. And the Peter Jackson movie makes something of this. They smoke something called pipe weed in the books, which Peter Jackson had a little bit of fun with, saying, well, is that a bit like dope? Which Tolkien was very keen that it wasn't seen as that. But again, that's a kind of hippie thing that the hippies could maybe get a bit of perch on. Amongst the hippies who loved it were the Beatles.
So they were actually big fans then of the story?
Apparently so, particularly John Lennon.
Okay.
Particularly John Lennon. So now, the Beatles have already made two movies and they have a contract with United Artists to make a third. Hard Day's Night and Help they've already made. Apparently, I don't know why, Yellow Submarine didn't count because it was an animated thing and whilst it used Beatle kind of imagery, it didn't have the Beatles in it and it didn't even have their voices in it. So from the point of view of United Artists, it didn't count. So Dennis O'Dell, the producer that they'd worked with on the first two Beatles films, he starts looking around for some ideas. An idea that comes up is The Lord of the Rings, amazingly. The Beatles like it. Lennon's really keen on it. Apple, the newly formed Apple Corporation, are keen on it. We're talking the end of the 60s. No one's quite sure when this happened. We think maybe 1969 this starts to occur.
Okay.
Maybe 68. Certainly late in the 1960s. So O'Dell, on behalf of the Beatles and Apple, starts to sound out some directors. They decide that Richard Lester, who's done the first two Beatles movies, isn't quite right for this. And so they start to think, and Lennon is very keen on it being Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. Mm. We should say as well that amongst other people who were keen on this idea was Donovan. Donovan's one of the Beatles circle who, I'll get on in a moment to who the Beatles were going to play.
That makes sense.
They were going to play in this, yeah.
Was Donovan going to be Gandalf? Oh no, you're going to tell us.
No,
okay.
No. Donovan is going to be Merry.
Okay.
One of the four hobbits.
Right.
Because I'd originally thought, we'll come back to this, but I'd originally thought that when I heard the Beatles were going to cast themselves in it, the obvious thing to do is that the Beatles will be the four hobbits. There's four hobbits and there's four... Not at all. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Donovan thinks that Twiggy should be in it as Galadriel, the elven princess, as it were. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they contact Stanley Kubrick, who's not read the books, and he says, I'll have a think about it. He looks into the books and he says, no, they're unfilmable.
Right.
They're absolutely unfilmable.
Is this because of all the special effects that you'd need that I guess weren't around at the time?
Absolutely, yeah.
But the thing is, though, you know, films with a kind of fantasy theme were made. I'm thinking of the BBC's Chronicles of Narnia, which I really enjoyed, even though the lion was clearly a robot. But people turned to stone and there were fawns and, you know, flying witches.
I think had they done it, it wouldn't have been anything like what we saw with the Peter Jackson things. Had they done it, and we'll come back to what they were going to do, I think we might be talking much more a kind of musical dressy up extravaganza, almost like Camelot or something like that, you know, almost like that kind of thing. Maybe something, as you say, not as frightening, not as, you know, militaristic maybe and sensational, but maybe something a bit more playful and psychedelic. Kubrick says it can't be done. It can't be filmed. You know, he says it's 500,000 words long. It's bigger than War and Peace. He doesn't like doing long films anyway. But Kubrick's right-hand man at the time, a guy called Leon Vitali, he said they did go for lunch with him. He says they came to Stanley's office to talk to him about it. He says it wasn't really in Kubrick's ballpark, but he says that Lennon was the driving force behind it because Lennon was crazy about 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, if these dates are right, that would mean that it is a 69. He was crazy about 2001 A Space Odyssey and watched it once a week. And he'd also loved things like Dr. Strangelove, so he really wanted Kubrick to do it. Other people apparently in consideration, Antonioni, who did Blow Up, who just had a big success with Blow Up.
Yeah, wow.
And so let's talk about what the idea was, though. The idea was that the Beatles would star in it.
Okay, so it wouldn't be a cartoon.
It would be live action, starring Paul McCartney as Frodo.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I can see that happening. Ringo Starr as Sam Gamgee, his loyal, you know, friend. Yeah. And again, fine.
Makes sense.
George Harrison as Gandalf.
Okay, curveball.
Do you think Eastern mysticism, all that, wizard?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And
okay.
John Lennon, on his own insistence, as Gollum. That's interesting, isn't it?
Wow.
That's interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah.
Interesting that Lennon
cast... What was he trying to say?
Well, I think he's trying to say, I'm an anti-hero, I'm a bit strange, I'm a bit odd. It's a bit like...
Yep.
When Sting wanted to do the Gormenghast trilogy and Sting wanted to cast himself as Steerpike. And if you know the Gormenghast trilogy, he's the slightly mischievous, malevolent, upstart kitchen boy who climbs his way to the top. And I think there's something going on that way with Lennon saying, no, I don't want to be one of the good guys. I want to be Gollum.
Okay.
I think that casting's actually pretty spot on if you think about the Beatles.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's pretty spot on.
I mean, having given up halfway through the first one, I'm not that.
You're probably not the expert. You know what? They weren't going to get you involved, I don't think, even if you'd been around at the time.
I'd have refused, like Kubrick and Tolkien himself.
Yeah. So anyway, but it just when Kubrick says no, the impetus kind of fails. But the main reason it fails, certainly why they didn't push on with getting new directors maybe, is that one person who very much didn't want it to happen was J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, amazing.
Tolkien nixed the idea. Anyway, he had the rights to the films. Now, he had moved in 1953 for his wife's health. He'd moved out to the countryside. He'd moved, semi-countryside in Oxford, Sandfield Road in Oxford. And he said in a letter that he wrote to a friend, he said he thought it was going to be peaceful and quiet, but it had radio, television, dogs, scooters and cars of all sizes making noise all day. And then he said, in addition, in a house three doors away dwells a member of a group of young men who are evidently aiming to turn themselves into a Beatle group. The noise is indescribable. Now, I have seen a YouTube documentary, a bizarrely, brilliantly inaccurate YouTube documentary that says that Tolkien actually moved next door to the Beatles.
Okay.
That's not true.
No.
Because the Beatles did not all live together in suburban Oxford. I think we know that. What Tolkien did say is that he moved into a street. Tolkien Street had some young lads in it who were trying to be a band like the Beatles.
Yeah. I mean, that is hellish. Who wants that? No one.
Well, no one. You're right. Certainly not Tolkien. So he nixed it anyway. So with the idea that Kubrick said it's unfilmable and Tolkien himself says, I absolutely don't want the Beatles. He was quite a conservative dude. I've read a letter of his where he talks about, he rails against the modern world. He says he doesn't like sanitation, which seems a bit odd. He doesn't like feminism. And he doesn't like morale pep. I've no idea what that means.
What? How weird.
But anyway, he didn't like pop music. He didn't like the Beatles. And so these two things, Tolkien's disapproval, Stanley Kubrick's insistence it was unfilmable, they don't go through, is it? So it's years and years later that Peter Jackson eventually makes the very successful movie franchise. But get this. Jackson met McCartney at the time, because we should know Jackson's also making a Beatles documentary at the moment called about Get Back, which I can't wait to see. He tells him, he says, he talks to Paul McCartney about it, and Paul said, yeah, it was something that John really wanted to do. Tolkien still had the film rights at that stage, but he didn't like the idea of us doing it, so he killed it off. And then he says, but it was a good job he killed it off, because if we'd made ours, you wouldn't have made yours. And yours is really good. Aww. And yours is better than ours would have been. So McCartney concedes that it might have been a disaster if right. the Beatles ever did.
How funny that Tolkien... I mean, okay, he may not have liked or been indifferent about the Beatles, but you'd have thought he could have seen the opportunity there. Them being...
What do you mean, financially?
Yeah, and them just being the biggest band in the world and getting his book out to a, you know, a new generation or... having well, it immortalised in yeah, that way.
I guess I so. I genuinely don't think things like that bothered him. He was a...
Yeah.
I mean, he was a philologist, really. He was interested in language. I mean, he didn't even really intend to become a successful novel. I mean, he says, you know, the tale grew in the telling, and the idea was for a linguistic expert, a philologist, to try his hand at an experiment in languages, really.
Right.
You know, cause, and if you've read The Lord of the Rings, which you, I know, haven't. I've struggled with, lots of it is about language. It's about Elvish and the Dark Tongue and things like that.
Okay. So,
but anyway, one last thing before we move off this topic, though. One of the other failed outlets for it, when they realised that this Tolkien thing wasn't going to work and they wondered what they could do for this third film with United Artists, they approached then-fashionable Leicester/London playwright Joe Orton.
Okay.
And asked him to write a Beatle movie. He wrote a script called Up Against It, which is extremely shocking and risque, so much so that Epstein said, no way are the Beatles doing that.
Wow.
But maybe that's a subject for another notable, the failed Beatle Joe Orton movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why were they so kind of, well, maybe not obsessed, but why were they concerned with going into the movies? You know, what was that about? Was it just a way to make, you know, continue working? Because I guess even at that time, I mean, they will have made their money, obviously, but even at that time, rock and roll, I suppose, was seen to be quite a short-lived thing, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't think they were obsessed, but I think certainly they had a 3-picture deal with United Artists, so they had to.
Yeah. I suppose Elvis made movies, so he'd set a precedent.
Elvis made
it.
Movies, but I think the Beatles probably were just, they were so huge and so successful and such a phenomenon that they probably just thought, why don't we do everything? I mean, you know,
yeah,
what I mean,
why not? Lennon, make hay.
Lennon wrote a couple of books. McCartney made avant-garde films. I think they were just probably thinking we can do anything we like. Yeah, I don't think they were particularly obsessed with the idea, but I think they were contractually obligated to find it. And of course, they do make a third real film, as it were, but that's Get Back, it's a documentary, and that's what Peter Jackson's making a film about now. So there's a nice little synchronicity.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
We should say that although George Harrison never got to play Gandalf, he did set up a production company called Handmade Films that actually were responsible for some very, very good British movies into the 80s, such as Time Bandits, With Nell and I, The Long Good Friday, A Private Function, and many more. So Harrison did have a film career of sorts, although just not as Gandalf. Notable exception?
Yep.
Are you interested in a notable exception? This is the part of the programme.
Yeah.
This is the part of the programme where we pause for a one-off, something unique. And there's hundreds, literally hundreds of musical adaptations or settings or works inspired by The Lord of the Rings. In the world of rock, you'll know like Bo Hansson's brilliant prog album, music inspired by Lord of the Rings. Led Zeppelin wrote songs about it. Black Sabbath wrote songs about it. Jack Bruce wrote a song about it. There's classical pieces about it. There's folk suites about it. Only one musical arrangement or music inspired by Lord of the Rings ever was approved by Tolkien. Only one thing ever got his seal of approval. And that is a series of settings of the songs from the books written by Donald Swan of Flanders and Swan.
Wow. Okay.
Called The Road Goes Ever On.
And which makes total sense, I suppose. If Tolkien didn't like the Beatles, then English light music seems like it'd be more up his street.
I've heard them. They're quite pleasant. It's English, as you say. It's exactly right. It's English light music. Yeah, it's quite nice. You can buy the sheet music should you want to tinkle the ivories and play them. But yeah, that was the only thing that passed Tolkien's muster, as it were, that he said that he liked that and he gave his approval to it, and he wrote some liner notes, Tolkien himself, to go with it.
Wow.
So that's
okay.
That's our notable exception.
Good to know. The next person we're going to talk about was also in the world of music and cinema. So, Josephine Baker, the extraordinary tale of her life. Very few people, if any, of which you can say they were an erotic dancer, a resistance fighter, a movie star, a civil rights activist, an internationally renowned singer. And she also adopted many children as well.
She's incredible.
Really incredible. It is incredible. And extraordinary, really, whatever your background. But she was born into real poverty, a woman of African and Native American heritage. She was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1906. And just to rattle through her childhood, although that is possibly a film on its own, her mother basically took the true identity of Josephine Baker's biological father to the grave with her. She never really knew who her real father was. It's thought he might have been a white man that Baker's mother was working for at the time. In the biography that her son wrote, though, he sort of describes her upbringing. I mean, it's abject poverty that we're talking about. It was one of the poorest districts in that town, a place full of brothels. The housing had outdoor plumbing. So we're talking outdoor sewers here. She started working as a living domestic from the age of six. That's in 1912. She was married for the first time by the age of 13.
Yeah.
That marriage lasted less than a year. She married again at the age of 15. Mm. By this point, she was also street dancing to make money, but clearly she showed some kind of extraordinary talent in it, because she basically ran away with the circus, got out of this poverty, was spotted by someone who led a troupe. First, she went to New York and she was dancing on Broadway, and then she went to Paris and she was dancing in the theatres of the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah.
And this is quite interesting because, I mean, we're talking relatively here, but Paris, for many African Americans at that time in the 1920s, actually turned out to be a less hostile place than America.
Yeah.
During the First World War, 200,000 African Americans had been brought to France. And then a lot of them actually decided to stay. Most of them, 9/10 actually of the 200,000 that were brought over decided to stay in France. And they lived mostly in Paris.
Didn't she say that when she first got on a train and went into a restaurant that she was amazed that she could sit wherever she wanted?
Absolutely, yeah. It was just a completely different landscape, socially, politically, just, you know, felt completely different. Facile de vous aimer. We see in Paris this kind of community of African Americans developing. Some Harlem Renaissance writers and poets and jazz musicians as well move there. Montmartre became a bit of a focal point for this kind of artistic African American scene. And that's why Paris developed this kind of really good, thriving jazz scene at that time as well. Later we see people like Stephen Grappelli and Django Reinhardt coming out of it. Clubs as well, such as La Grande Duke, Chez Florence and Bricktops, which was so named after Ada Bricktop, who was a American dancer, African-American as well. It's rumoured that she and Josephine Baker had a fling. So Josephine, you know, she was bisexual as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she was amongst kind of all these other African-Americans at the time. There weren't many, but, you know, she was part of this kind of, I suppose, more inviting community of artists and writers and that sort of thing in Paris during the 1920s. Having said that, she still caused some scandal, mostly though, because she danced essentially semi-nude, her modesty protected only by a string of bananas.
That's right. And some feathers occasionally,
The odd feather, yeah. I mean, that would turn some heads, yeah. I think, even on any stage here in Manchester in the 21st century. I've no first-hand experience, but it's just my hunch. So she was massively ahead of her time, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And Paris was just so ahead of its time at that time. I think that's incredible. Reading about this, you just think, gosh, what a place it must have been. You know, that she could come from St. Louis at that time and have this career. It just went from strength to strength. Hemingway, he called her the most sensational woman ever. He encountered her in Paris. Picasso was inspired by her. Jean Cocteau became friendly with her. He catapulted her into a movie career. So just one of the many extraordinary achievements in her life. She's also the first black woman to star in a major film. In 1927, she was in the silent film Siren of the Tropics. Then it was only to get more colourful after this. So World War II started. And I guess at that time, she could have just possibly enjoyed, you know, the attention of the German soldiers, of being a celebrity, of performing for the Nazi troops. Instead, she joined the French Resistance. She did have this access, I suppose, that her celebrity status gave her. So she had access to the parties where high-ranking Nazis would be present. Yeah. She would charm them, and then she would collect information. And then because she was able to tour, she would go to neutral countries like Portugal and Sweden, and she would stitch the secrets or write the secrets in her underwear. And she would then relay this to the English.
I love this thing that she...
Such a dangerous game.
I love this thing that she was asked by Jacques Abte, the head of French counter-military intelligence, would she spy, essentially? Would she help them in the espionage?
Yeah.
And she said, "France made me what I am. I will be grateful forever. The people of Paris have given me everything. I am ready, Captain, to give them my life. You can use me as you wish." That's a pretty brilliant thing to say, isn't it?
It's amazing. What a woman. It's so inspiring, isn't it? Because that is life. It's life risking, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's such a dangerous game. So deservedly, after the war, she received the Resistance Medal, the Croix de Guerre, and the Legion of Honour, which are some of France's highest
The Legion d'Honneur is the highest order of merit you can get in France, isn't it? Charles de Gaulle gave her this, didn't he, in 1945. She also, when you were telling what she did, when you were telling how she took the secrets around the world, I love this one. She carried information, she carried over 50 classified documents by writing down the information in invisible ink on her sheet music.
Yeah, amazing.
It's amazing.
I know, it really is. And then you think after the war, I mean, you think that would be all quite exhausting, and that she'd had, you know, enough traumatic experiences by this point, in, even though she was quite young, I think I'd feel quite exhausted. But it just carries on. So she basically supports the civil rights movement in the States after this, and gets really involved. She joins Martin Luther King at rallies. She wrote articles about the abhorrence of segregation. She refused to perform to segregated audiences. She was actually asked to join the civil rights movement leadership after the death of Martin Luther King by his wife, Coretta. Mm. She did actually refuse because she was worried at that time about the safety of her children. She was invited by Castro to perform in Cuba. She became friends with Grace Kelly, who actually let Josephine Baker live in one of her properties when Baker fell into financial trouble later in her life. Yeah.
Apparently, the FBI had nearly 500 pages of documents on her, which anybody of mixed ethnicity who was left-leaning at the time would certainly have attracted the attention of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. But 500 pages is an awful lot, isn't it?
Absolutely. I wonder actually what they were looking for. Well, I guess it would be her involvement in the civil rights movement, wouldn't it?
How long do you reckon your file with the FBI is?
Well, since I got Terry, I think it's probably definitely got bigger because he...
Do you think?
Yeah, because he's quite aggressive and he's been banned from doggy daycare already. So
he's going to trouble at doggy daycare, isn't he? Yeah. That we'll have to leave that for a separate pod. But I reckon mine's quite small, probably, just about a page.
She had this chateau near the Dordogne, Chateau de Milande. And that's a place that she also chose to raise 12 adopted children.
Wow.
And they were of Japanese, Korean, French, Israeli, Colombian, Finnish, Venezuelan, Algerian and Moroccan descent.
Wow.
She called it her rainbow family.
Wow.
The grounds to the chateau were open and she would let tourists kind of go there and see how she was raising these children and what an inclusive kind of family and environment it was to raise children. And the whole point was that other people could see that people of all different backgrounds and ethnicities could be brothers and sisters. I mean, how beautiful is that? Yeah. And just to end what is an incredible life, she kind of died as poetically as she'd lived. I mean, her career saw, you know, there were ebbs and flows, and there were moments where she was more popular than others. I think it was always a frustration to her that she was never quite as big in the States as she was in France. Mm-hmm. Some of the reviews, I mean, I wouldn't even read them, but they are shockingly racist. Right. These are reviews by the American press. Yeah. But yeah, her death. So in the mid-70s, there was a performance which was the story of her life. It was a retrospective. It was staged at the Babino in Paris, and she actually starred in it. And then 4 days later, she was found in her bedroom surrounded by rave reviews. And she basically, I think she'd had a break. They think she'd had a brain hemorrhage, but she died basically in her sleep, right. Age 68.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say, having packed a lot in to those 68 years.
Good that she was surrounded by her rave reviews. So we'd like to think she went out just happy, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. There is just something quite beautiful about that, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a life.
What a woman.
What a woman, I know. Incredible. Josephine Baker.
Incredible. Well, Josephine Baker, erotic dancer, activist,
Civil rights
campaigner.
French resistance.
Yeah.
movie star.
And the Beatles, how they
Mother
didn't
to
make
many.
A Lord of the Rings movie. So that is our first notable of the new season. Let us know what you think. Subscribe. Get in touch. Also, are there some stories you'd like us to investigate and retell for you? I mean, there may be something you've heard. You mean, you might have heard some kind of urban myth, or you might have heard some, not an urban myth, but an actual factual thing that you think, oh, I'd like to know more about that. Let us know. Get in touch with us on Twitter.
Maybe there's a curious tale from your hometown.
Yeah, we're at Notable Pod if you want to get in touch with us on social media. We will be back next week with something else. Should we keep our powder dry and mysterious for now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do know, though, don't we?
Oh,
we've got it all mapped out.
Don't for a moment think we have. I would really. Don't for a moment think we haven't decided yet what we're doing.
You've seen the planner for season one. The high-tech.
Exactly. Well, there's an
season one planner.
There's an even more elaborate. Go online if you want to see the planner for season one on Post-it notes in Jeff's garden. But there'll be an even more high-tech one that we'll post soon for this.
Cool.
Notable. The podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.